Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This Sunday is St. Patrick's Day, the day when everyone is at least a little bit Irish. But there are many Iowans who do have genuine Irish heritage. The Irish are the second largest immigrant group in Iowa history. And this hour, we'll talk about this Irish heritage and how the Irish shaped our infrastructure and our culture. Historian Timothy Walsh is here. He is the director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library, the author of many books, and his most recent is Irish Iowa. Tim, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here, Charity. I just have to stop myself from saying top of the morning to you.
You didn't stop yourself. You just did it. So, Tim, before we dig into Iowa history, you have Irish heritage, quite a lot of it as well, right?
I was 12 years old, living on the east side of Detroit, before I realized that I was not a member of God's chosen people. When you live among the Irish, you feel it's special. And whether it's Melrose, Iowa, or it's the east side of Detroit, you have that special feeling. And it is comforting. You have many second cousins and aunts and uncles. And it's a matter of pride. And we see it here in Iowa, and you see it in Chicago and just about any place else in the United States.
Well, and we think about Irish conclaves in Chicago, in Detroit, in Boston, in New York City. We think about many of the Irish immigrants as being urban people, but a lot of Irish came to Iowa.
The lure of the land. I mean, they were agricultural people in Ireland, and if they had the wherewithal, the determination, or any kind of resources to get themselves west. And so if they got as far as Boston or New York, and they picked up a handbill from Charles Corkery of Dubuque saying, this land is so productive, you can grow more potatoes in Iowa than you could ever in Ireland. Well, my goodness, by wagon or by train, they came west. Or if, thanks to a ship going to New Orleans, they were able to travel north on the Mississippi, they could settle in Wexford or Jackson County and establish themselves and buy land cheap. And so there was a strong agricultural tradition among the Irish in Iowa. It is true that many Irish lived in Iowa cities, but they also developed the land in all of the counties of Iowa.
Now, the first thing that brought Irish to Iowa, though, was not land. It was lead, right?
Yes, indeed. The Irish were very much involved in the work, the infrastructure work, that essentially drawing out the natural resources, building the buildings in the cities of Iowa, as well as tilling the land. And so it was the mines. It was a rough time in the early days. And in fact, the first murder in Iowa was committed by one Irishman against another, and of course he was the man who was convicted. O'Connor was taken to his funeral by making him sit in his own coffin with a priest in there with him. It was a rather unusual event.
And had some repercussions for the Irish community after that. That priest had a hard time with his flock after that, didn't he?
He wanted mercy, but the Irish weren't quite so merciful. There was more vengeance at that time. That having been said, the first Catholic baptism in Iowa was also done with an Irish child by an Irish priest. So, you know, there's a little bit that balances itself off. They were here early developing the lead mines and whatever other resources they could harvest, because they came with determination, but they came with few monetary resources.
So we see this Irish community really developing in Dubuque and along the Mississippi. And of course, that's where development really started in Iowa, period, was along the Mississippi. But in the 1840s, of course, came the Great Famine in Ireland. And so many, many Irish fled the country to try to save their own lives. Is that when the allure of the land started?
What you have is a convergence of two experiences. One is the push, which is in effect the famine, which says we have to go someplace. And people would gather together what resources they have, and they would hold a wake because they knew that the family member who was leaving would not be coming back. And so they said goodbye. But then there was the lure lure, which was the handbills that people like Charles Corkery of Dubuque and others distributed in the ports of Ireland and England, saying, come to the West, come to this emerald Garden of Eden where you can grow whatever you want. So the idea was, there's nothing here for me in Ireland, and I can go west and grow potatoes beyond imagination in Iowa. And so that's what pulled them here. You had people also like Bishop Loras, as well as Corkery, who realized that the way Iowa could prosper, it recently becoming a territory, how it could achieve statehood was by populating itself. And who better to populate than to add Catholics? As far as Bishop Loras was concerned, he'd take any Catholic he could get. But they were also people who spoke English, so they had that asset going for them. And so you have both a push and a pull that brings the Irish here.
Well, and you talk about those handbills. I mean,
yes.
There were people in Iowa or with ties to Iowa who were advertising heavily.
In places like Boston, in the Boston Pilot, or New York in the Freeman's Journal, in the Catholic newspaper, saying, come to Iowa. It's like selling land in Florida, I suppose, or development properties. And of course, these were people who came to this country who were risk takers. They had aspirations and goals. And so that ambition is what drove them west. And it was a considerable effort. Some were very cautious. Some stayed in New York and Philadelphia and Boston. But there were others who were adventuresome who said, I'm going west to Iowa, and were advised to do so by priests and by newspaper editors and others. There was great opportunity out here. Why not, seize that opportunity, particularly if you could buy land for $1.25 an acre?
Driven by poverty and by hunger, was that a real barrier to the people, the pioneers who were coming here to live these very difficult lives? I mean, they weren't in great physical condition, and life here was hard.
Imagine, we sometimes, I think, romanticize the notion of immigration. We fail to realize the tremendous cost and hardship it was to climb into the leaky hull of a ship and spend 6 weeks on the ocean and then come to this country where there's hostility toward your religion, where you have no assets or resources, where you're not absolutely sure where you're going to go, but still have the wherewithal and the optimism to say, I can make it. And so we are a nation of risk takers. We are a nation of people who have a hardy physical constitution that helped them to resist illness. And so in a way, as a nation, when we sometimes say we're exceptional, or as an Irish people, we say we're exceptional, it is true. And you'll sometimes hear this from Irish grandmothers saying, oh, the best ones were the ones that left. And the idea was, certainly the best ones were the ones who survived, and whether they survived in Ireland or they survived in Iowa was determined by their physical constitution, their ability to resist disease and handle adversity.
So we had Irish settling in our towns, and we had Irish settling in the landscape and farming. What kinds of jobs were the more, urban is kind of a strong word considering how little these towns
were. They were pretty small.
But what kinds of jobs drew the Irish to those communities?
When you look at the statistics and you look at the census, they were often listed as laborers. So we don't quite know beyond that. But they were probably longshoremen. Many of them were draymen. They were building and construction. It is true, of course, some entered the clergy, some became newspaper editors. There were a few lawyers, but in general, it was what we would consider working class. And then, of course, as Iowa's railroads began to spread across the state, the people who were hired to work those railroads, to cut the timbers and lay the track, were as often as not railroad people. So we're Irish who worked on the railroad and then took jobs as engineers and as station agents and so forth. So the railroads were important to the Irish, and the Irish were important to the railroads.
Let's talk about Irish women, because, of course, women often get written out of history.
Yes.
And the Irish women who came here were incredibly important. Among them were a lot of nuns who came to the state. Tell
me about that. We tend not to think of the importance of women who aggregate together in self-determination, who choose not to marry and have children, who profess vows, who come to a state like Iowa, a frontier, as did Mother Mary Frances Clark and the Sisters of Charity, the Blessed Virgin Mary, and to essentially begin to establish a privately operated schools for the betterment of children of any religious faith, and more particularly Sisters of Mercy, who came in the 1850s and to operate all of the various hospitals. When you go to a Mercy hospital in the case of an emergency, you're being touched by an Irish Catholic woman who made a difference in the quality of life in that community, whether it's in Fort Dodge or it's in Dubuque or it's in Iowa City or Cedar Rapids or wherever. So that they were extraordinary women who sometimes were oppressed by the priests and the bishops who were, condescending in their attitude toward these women, but they learned how to work around them. There's a wonderful quote about Sister Mary Charles Borromeo, who ran the hospital, Mercy Hospital, in Davenport, and somebody said, what accounted for her success? And the comment was, Mother Borromeo knew how to handle men. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think women who in this country, who came here, Irish Catholic women who chose not to marry, they would often operate boarding houses. They would go into domestic service, so they would learn a lot from the households where they were established. And, in effect, they weren't victims. They were risk takers. They took on a lot of tasks and made a big difference. If you look at the statistics, the census in Dubuque in 1860, there's really more Irish-born women than there are Irish-born men. When you add both the single women and the married women,
interesting.
Them as well.
Yeah. So many of our hospitals, or especially our early hospitals, were the result of Irish immigrants.
Yes, sure, absolutely. In fact, the University Hospital here in Iowa City was the direct result of a collaboration between the medical faculty and Mercy Hospital here in Iowa City. Now, of course, eventually that was separated, but we have a wonderful Mercy Hospital as well as a University Hospital because of two groups collaborating. And you see this across the country. You see Mayo, the collaboration between women religious and the Mayo brothers in terms of the quality of health care there as well. So, yes, when you see Mercy, it's not just an institution, it's a way of life.
I'm talking with Timothy Welch. His latest book is Irish Iowa, and we're talking about the Irish in Iowa, how they shaped our infrastructure and our culture. And of course, we want to hear from you. What's your Irish heritage? Tell us about the founders of your Irish community. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Irish in Iowa. They make up the second largest immigrant group in Iowa history. We're talking about how Irish immigrants helped to shape our infrastructure and our culture. Historian Timothy Welch is here. He is the director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and the author of many books. His most recent is Irish Iowa. You are also welcome to join our conversation, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we're going to get to some calls and dig into some stories here pretty soon. But Tim, I want to ask you about discrimination against the Irish. It's something that, you know, we hear quite a bit about. Again, those stories from the big cities, no Irish need apply signs on
right,
stores.
Right.
Was there a discrimination issue against Irish in the state?
In some ways, the tendency is for the Irish actually in Iowa to be accepted because they were needed. Their work was needed and they were appreciated. And you often saw in papers from local groups of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants saying, no, we need these Irish people. They're really important. But there was also a tendency on the part of some to be very suspicious of the Catholic Church. They weren't quite sure about those nuns who were establishing that hospital. They'd never quite seen them. And they were also hearing from Eastern cities about, suspicious plots and that sort of thing. And sometimes rumors would spread. there was no question there was a know-nothing movement here in Iowa in the 1850s.
Okay, and tell us a little bit more.
Know-nothings were essentially saying they knew, it was a nickname that came from knowing very little about the organization in which they were a member. It was an Americanist party, that is pro-American, and opposing all ethnic groups. And they saw people who were Irish and to some extent German as being loyal to this horrible Pope in Rome. In fact, one preacher in Cincinnati got up in his pulpit and said, you know, the Jesuits have built a university at St. Louis and they intend to move the Pope to the United States and take over the country. So there was a lot of hostility swirling around the country, and inevitably some of it got into Iowa. The irony was the counties that had the strongest anti-Catholic views were those counties in southern Iowa where there were no Catholics at all. So once you met a Catholic or you worked with an Irish Catholic, you tended to accept them. It was the ignorance that precipitated the hostility. And it quickly dissipated. By the middle of the 1850s, it was gone. And there, generally speaking, was a polite acceptance of the Irish up until the 1890s, when almost out of a sudden in Clinton, Iowa, there emerged the American Protective Association, which again was a kind of a renewal of this hostility toward the Catholics primarily as being un-American. And it all stemmed from a local mayoral election in Clinton in which the Catholic priest had exerted a certain amount of influence and the Catholic candidate won. And Henry Bowers decided that wouldn't do and established an organization, and it seemed to touch on hostility in other parts of the country. But again, once Bowers died, the organization kind of dissipated. So there was always a little bit of that sense. And then going even up into the 1920s, we had the Ku Klux Klan here in Iowa. And there was a story about one family, the Cahill family in West Branch, who a large Catholic family moving from one farm to another and happened upon a Klan rally. And I don't think either group knew what quite to do, but there was no violence. The Cahills were allowed to pass on peacefully back to their farm. But there was always those stories that would pass on, you know, family to family. Oh, be careful. So Ireland was not without a certain amount of anti-Catholicism and anti-Irish sentiment, and particularly as reflected in the Know Nothing Party in the 1850s and the American Protective Association in the 1890s.
And Jim is on the line in Spencer and has a little family history with the Ku Klux Klan in Iowa protesting the Irish. Hi, Jim.
Hi. We're, you know, Clay County is got quite a few Irish, and Emmitsburg is near here. They're heavily Irish, but I was shocked to see photographs of the KKK marching in Peterson, Iowa. And this would have been around 1920-25, protesting, you know, any Irish inhabitants in, you know, in their community. And it, you know, they had the hoods and the robes and everything, and you know, it was a big crowd on the streets. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that I think one community would be unique in their particular viewpoint, I think. But so, it was shocking to see in Iowa that sort of thing just over Irish.
Right. Well, and we know that it wasn't just the Irish that were the focus of the Ku Klux Klan in Iowa. German Catholics
sure.
also were the focus of this kind of discrimination. But Jim, before I let you go, you grew up Irish in Iowa. So what did that mean to you as you were growing up? Was there a pride in your Irish heritage?
Well, yes. Had Irish relatives on both sides of my family. And, you know, it was very important to wear green on St. Patrick's Day. I mean, you might even get dressed up as St. Patrick for Halloween if your green tablecloth was handy. We
That's great.
Spent a lot of time with all of the Irish, the songs and the traditions, the foods, of, you know. We got to hear many stories about the potato famine and the various Irish members of our families on both sides, and probably close to, you know, 5/8 Irish in my blood. So good enough.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for your call. And Tim, you wanted to comment.
Well, it's just, it's amazing to me in many cases, and I don't know how long Jim's family's been here, but the Irish have been here since the 1850s, and yet five, six generations later, we still remember those roots, that heritage and that pride. And folks still go out and plan the parade, or they still dress in green or whatever, even though they're far more American in terms of the length of time living in a country. But there's a love. And in fact, Ireland very much depends upon the fact that the Irish people of Irish heritage go back and visit if they can find relatives, or just to be nostalgic about the past.
Laura is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Laura.
Good morning, and thank you for mentioning Melrose, the birthplace of my father, James, who's still living. And we returned to the Georgetown community just north of Melrose in western Iowa, in western Monroe County, southern Iowa. My mother was born in Weller, an Irish settlement about 10 miles north of there, where my great-grand baron, Grand Quinn Baron, was the community midwife. And she rode out on horseback, became a widow at a young age, young mother, and had six children. And also, given our complicated history as Irish Catholics with the church, for my family, all settling in the 1850s in Georgetown, Melrose, Weller, and a small settlement called Tyrone, if it hadn't been for the priests and the nuns in the family, we never would have become part of the educated class. And certainly that was what brought my father and his siblings first to the Ottumwa Heights, the boarding school the nuns had there, which was my aunt's order. Her mother and father were born in Ireland, my great-grandmother, Bridget McTeague. And then also on my mother's side out of Weller, the Morrisseys and the Barons had lots of priests. And then my grandfather, John Morrissey, was able to go to St. Ambrose Prep, leave the country school and go there to get some education. And the Catholic Church provided that opportunity.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for calling.
And just a shout out too, Melrose is celebrating St. Patrick's Day with their homecoming celebration on March 16th at the Community Center. So that all you Melrose Irish and who want to remember too, the Fighting Shamrocks, that was their basketball team from 1937, first undefeated basketball team, high school basketball team in the state.
Right, and
of
you
Iowa.
Include a picture of them in the book.
They're still remembered in Melrose.
Right. You also write about Melrose, Iowa's most famous son.
That Father Leo Ward, who at the age of about 20 left Melrose, he came back to visit, but he recalled and wrote about life in Melrose in his youth and mentioned Tyrone and Georgetown. He taught in Tyrone and talked about the whole experience of being Irish, and then wrote a book called Holding Up the Hills, which talked about the struggle and the suffering that went on, not just among Irish households in Monroe County, but in many ways you can generalize from it how difficult and devastating the Depression was. And we know that the Depression visited every farm right. family without regard to ethnicity.
Well, and I want to ask a question based on what Laura was saying. So many of the Irish who came were fleeing poverty, were fleeing famine, and also were not educated people. Is that part of what made them so focused on education in Iowa?
I think what you see among people who left, who were risk takers, is ambition. And there was a native intelligence, and they did see that there was great value in this essentially white Anglo-Saxon Protestant culture that they were entering, that the more knowledge and education they had, the better their opportunity in advancing themselves. So that ambition combined with their native intelligence made a big difference. And so you do see them focusing a lot on education and skill. One of the interesting things, too, when we talk about teaching, for example, as a profession among unmarried women, is that many of these young women who were second and third daughters in Irish Catholic families would go on to become public school teachers in Dubuque and Davenport and elsewhere. And of course, their sisters, if they entered the religious order, were teaching in the parochial school. So whether you were public or whether you're Protestant or Catholic, you were getting
a Catholic education
one way or another. Not the same curriculum,
right.
But there was that Irish Catholic influence on right and wrong and value. values and that sort of thing. And that was very true in Chicago and bigger cities.
Interesting. I'm talking with Timothy Welch. He is the author most recently of Irish Iowa. And also with us in the studio today, a proud Irish Iowan, Ken Donnelly of Iowa City. Hello, Ken.
Hi there.
And everything I see you nodding your head to pretty much everything Tim has said today. Does this sound like your family history?
Well, when Tim spoke of the nuns, I'd have to say that I owe the first 12 years of my education to religious sisters, St. Patrick's Grade School in Iowa City and Iowa City, Regina. And these were, again, Frances Clark's Sisters of the Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And I'm still in contact with one of my nuns. She's still alive, Sister Mary Robert Emmett. Now, imagine a Catholic nun being named after a Protestant who was executed by the British in the early 1800s, fighting for Irish freedom. And then also, I was born at Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. Dr. George Callahan, it was an Irish doctor there at that moment. Mm-hmm. And a funny story there, if I may. My father owned a tavern, and in those days, the taverns closed at midnight. And this was a hot July night, and Frank Fitzpatrick and Johnny Welsh were at the tavern, and every half hour they'd call Mercy Hospital and say, is there any news on the Donnelly kid? Because, of course, in those days, we didn't know what sex a child was.
Sure.
And why did they do that? Because they knew there'd be free beer on the house the birth of the first child.
They were waiting for the beer to flow, huh?
I didn't come into the world till about 11:30 p.m., so I saved my father, a bundle of money because those two
Ken
Irishmen.
Ken was a favored child.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's just share this tidbit that I know a lot of people who know you well know, but you're talking about Donnelly's Tavern, your father's mm-hmm. bar.
Yes.
And your father was the first barkeep in Iowa to sell green beer, right?
Correct. I once went to Dave Rasdahl, who was a well-known Cedar Rapids Gazette columnist, and said, here's an idea for a column. And he put it in his column, and we heard from no one else in Iowa to contradict this. But it was St. Patrick's Day, 1935. And my dad was only 22 years old. He had opened the tavern just a few months before in October 34 and came up with the idea of having green beer. And, of course, that's found everywhere now. But we have not found anybody else in Iowa who said we did it before he did.
No. Wow. And do you know of anyone else in the country that was doing it before he did?
No. In Miami of Ohio College, the students have a green beer thing they started in the 50s or 60s. But that comes after our sort of thing.
Yeah. All right. So no. Stroke of genius. Who knows? Maybe that is where it started. And you mentioned that your father started that tavern in 1934, very shortly after Prohibition was repealed. So he was on the cutting edge of that as well.
Well, he was only 21, but Pabst Blue Ribbon was looking for an outlet in a college town, Iowa City. And so they helped him get started there. And he remained loyal for the whole 40 years. He only had that one beer on tap, Pabst Blue Ribbon. Now, I go to a bar today, and it takes the waitress 10 minutes to tell me what kind of beer they have. On tap. I mean, I'm not kidding. But in those days, one. PBR.
Wonderful.
Throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, and the importance of Donnelly's is not to be underestimated, because the saloon or the tavern was the poor man's social club. And so many of these Irish workers were doing hard manual labor. They needed something at the end of the day to give them a little respite. And so the saloon was the great place to go. And Donnelly's really carried that tradition forward. But I also want to single Ken out because he's been an historian for many years and, of course, has saved a lot of the documentation, photographs and pictures and so forth of the family farm, because they started out not as tavern keepers. That's his father's generation. They started out as farmers in Benton County. And the Kellys, there's a wonderful picture in the book of Mary Ryan Kelly, and it looks like kind of a mugshot after she's been arrested. She's tired, you know. But it was an arduous experience, not only to raise children, but then to work the farm, because the notion of a farm wife just working in the kitchen or cleaning the house is absolutely wrong. They were working side by side with their husbands. They were
absolutely.
Farmers.
Well, and some of them were working off the farm, too. You write about a woman who regularly walked 26 miles to Cedar Rapids
well,
to go
and
to
this
work.
Is one of Ken's relatives.
Okay.
Yes.
But
Bridget.
Bridget, yes. And I'm not going to dispute her story, but yes. There's some Herculean efforts to get to work, but the Irish love a good story, and there's no one alive to dispute it. So we'll accept Bridget at her word. You know, so say we all.
The Kellys supposedly said there were no houses between their farm in Van Horn, Benton County, and the city of Cedar Rapids when they arrived there in 1855.
Yeah. Wow.
No other houses.
So, yeah, and of course they were one of the Irish, many Irish, who came up from, they landed in New Orleans. So it wasn't always in New York or Boston or Philadelphia, but traveling north up the Mississippi River and settling first, interestingly enough, in Illinois, and then coming back across the river to settle in Benton County.
Right, we think of all those trips through Ellis Island, and
there's a different way to get here. Before that, Castle Garden, yeah, the Irish came in even before Ellis Island. But the truth is that they weren't all coming from eastern seaports.
We are going to take a short break. We will be back in just a moment. We are talking about the Irish in Iowa. If that's part of your family history, give us a call. Tell your story. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Timothy Walsh is here with me today. His most recent book is Irish Iowa, and we have proud Irish Iowan Ken Donnelly of Iowa City here today, and many, many more stories to tell. But again, we want to hear your stories too. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about Irish immigrants in Iowa. The Irish became the second largest immigrant group to settle in Iowa. Many of them settled in our cities. Many of them settled the countryside as well. They helped to build our railroads and our hospitals and our churches and our schools and have influenced Iowa culture in many ways. With me today, historian Timothy Walsh. He is the director emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and the author of many books. His most recent just came out. It's Irish Iowa. We also have proud Irish Iowan Ken Donnelly of Iowa City here, and we'd love to hear from you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. And I want to take Eileen on the air in Des Moines right now. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
I just want to give a shout out to the St. Patrick Society's Grand Parade, which is going to be this Saturday in the Quad Cities. And it is the only St. Patrick's Day parade that's a bi-state parade. It starts in Illinois and it ends in Iowa.
Nice.
And I have marched it probably 30 some times, and there's no matter what the weather is, there's tens of thousands of people watching that parade.
Well, Eileen, thanks for the shout out.
Yes, and it's just growing up Irish in my family. We all know all the Irish songs, and most of them have to do with whiskey and beer. And it's just a great. They have a great memorial project where they have a statue that they brought in from the stones from County Donegal in Ireland. And so if you're in Davenport, you should check that out.
All right, Eileen, thanks a lot for your call. And, of course, we talked a lot about the Irish community in Dubuque, but Davenport large
as well.
Irish community.
Absolutely. In fact, there's an extraordinary statue downtown in honor of the immigrants who came to, the Irish immigrants who came to Davenport. And the Davenport Irish have remained an important part of the story, thanks in part to Michael Gannon, Michael Valentine Gannon, one of the leaders of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, great name, an active still group that's active today in support of Irish causes, who lived in Davenport, and then also the Sharon family, who were the publishers of the Iowa Messenger, and now it's the Catholic Messenger. The Sharon family were avid supporters of Irish independence and famine relief, because even though the Irish struggled in the years before the Civil War with famine, they also had famine in subsequent years. And it was, interestingly enough, the visit of Charles Stewart Parnell. Folks know Parnell, Iowa. Where did the name come from? A three-day visit by Charles Stewart Parnell, who was head of the Irish Parliamentary Party, raising money for food relief and for Irish independence in the 1880s. And the Iowa Irish just, you know, flocked to him. So it was he was a rock star. So.
and I want to mention, too, this comment from Mason. He says, Irish flags are flying high above Waterloo this week to kick off Iowa Irish Fest on St. Patrick's Day. And, of course, there are many St. Patrick's Day celebrations going.
So parade on television if you can't make it. Oh, goodness gracious.
Just a shout out to Eileen, if you're still listening. I've been to your wonderful parade several times. I probably waved to you from the Harney family float.
Nice. Well, and Ken, I want to talk to you about your family history, because, of course, one of the things that made the Irish so influential in Iowa is that not only did they come here in large numbers, but then they had very large families. So you come from a long line of Donnellys, and there are lots of you, right?
Yes, if you go to my mother's side, the Gatons family, Ed Gatons and Ellen McGee, who married in 1878, had 12 children. And sadly, only six lived to adulthood, but a large family has resulted from that. The Kellys had 10 children, the Benton County Kellys, and all 10 of those lived to adulthood. So I have cousins I don't even know about in that clan.
Yeah, DNA is going to bring together even more Irish. I'm
right.
Not sure whether this is a social problem or not. But.
I want to bring up, this is from Paula. She says, don't forget New Mallory Abbey outside of Dubuque. Mm-hmm. And I know that you wrote a bit about it. I'll mention her connection. She says, my great-great-uncle Dom Albrecht Dunley was one of the first head abbots in the 1850s. His nephew, Dennis Dunley, immigrated to Iowa at his uncle's behest. Dennis then married a good German girl and settled in Dubuque, where my mother was born and raised.
People should visit New Mallory. It is a real treasure that tends to be overlooked, I think, in part. But it was, in fact, Bishop Loris inviting the monks from Mallory to establish a new Mallory here in Iowa. And because, of course, there was a great need for Irish priests. So the Irish who immigrated here weren't interested in missionary priests. They did accept the occasional missionary visit, but they wanted their native Irish priests. And the new Mallory promised to offer that support.
And this is a question from Bob. And you also write about this. He's wondering if the same pastor who would be the Catholic priest for German Catholics and Italian Catholics would also be the priest for Irish Catholics?
It's a great question, and I'm going to answer this by talking a little bit about St. Mary's in Iowa City, if you've ever been there. Because when the Catholics of Iowa City said they wanted to build a church, the Irish wanted their own church. They wanted a St. Patrick's Church. Well, the Germans weren't going to abide by that, and the bishop forced them to build a single church, St. Mary's, a neutral saint, so to speak. Well, the way they dealt with this issue was they had a statue of St. Patrick on one side of the altar and a statue of St. Boniface, who's the patron saint of Germany, on the other side of order, and the Germans sat on one side and the Irish sat on the other. And even that didn't last very long, because I think St. Mary's opened up in 1871 or two, and I think by 1879 they were constructing St. Patrick's. So the Irish, it was certainly acceptable for Irish Catholics to preach to Czechs and Poles and other Germans and so forth. It wasn't acceptable to those other ethnic groups.
Interesting. Yeah.
If somebody from St. Mary's married somebody from St. Pat's, some probably thought that was a mixed marriage.
Yes, that's right. You're absolutely right. Although the Irish-German combination is a common one and a fruitful one. In fact, I think Ken, you've got some German cousins, or part Irish and part German.
A number of the Kellys married Germans. Yes you're right.
866-780-9100 is the number to call. And Katrina's on the line next from Dubuque. Hi, Katrina.
Hello.
Hi, what's your story?
My story is that my great-great-great uncle, whose father emigrated in the 1850s, we think before the famine in Ireland, came to Wisconsin, and then great-great-great uncle Jim ended up coming to Keswick. And it was through his largesse that he actually donated the land for the St. Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church that just closed within the last, not too long ago.
Oh, interesting. Thanks for sharing, Katrina. Of course, a lot of these, we were talking about so many Irish farmers. Of course, they would be very far away from a church.
It was always a challenge to find a place to gather for worship if you lived on the farm. And there were a number of sizable Catholic churches that were built thanks to the donation of land and then also labor and at various settlements. And, of course, it's been a real struggle for these dioceses to support these little parishes because the families, of course, have declined. Folks have moved to town. In many ways, Harold Donnelly was prototypical of what Irish young men did. If they didn't want to continue farming, they came to town and they found work. And Donnelly's, of course, is an institution, to say the least.
Let's talk about some of the other famous Irish families in Iowa. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the Shelley family from Boone County. And of course, many of us have heard the name Kate Shelley. But tell us a little bit about the family.
Well, the family struggled, as many Irish families did. They had Michael Shelley had worked on the railroad and then had started to continue to farm. He'd purchased some land joining the railroad relatively cheaply and then died, unfortunately, and leaving his wife and two children to care for themselves. But what changed the fate of the family forever was a storm that wiped out a bridge. Taking a tremendous amount of personal courage, walked along the tracks to get to the station to warn the oncoming train that the bridge had been washed out. And she became a kind of overnight celebrity and was feted by the state legislature and eventually ended up being the station agent. And in fact, just an extraordinary life. So the story of this young girl and her personal courage really gave the Irish a sort of claim to fame outside the state of Iowa.
Well, and of course, Jack Shelley, who was part of that
same family.
Of our most famous broadcasters ever in Iowa.
Well, and I like to say she's one of two Kates because, of course, the other Kate Mulgrew from Dubuque, who, of course, goes on to Star Trek fame, is a descendant of the McGrew Coal and Ice Company. So her ancestor was hauling coal and ice in Dubuque many years, probably about the same time as Kate Shelley was saving those trains.
Let's go back to the phones. Michael is on the line in Hopper. Hi, Michael. Oh, I think Michael is gone. His wife has aunts who were Irish and taught country school in rural Keokuk, but I'm afraid we've lost him there. Tim is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi. My
grandfather was from County Cork, and he was born in 1883. And then he traveled across the ocean. He was on steamships back and forth. He worked his way 17 times. And then he became a hobo and traveled the rails throughout the United States. And at one time he worked for Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, pitching straw. And Buffalo Bill saw he had a terrible pair of boots on and gave him a pair of his old secondhand deerskin moccasins that laced up to the knee. Of course, they were secondhand. They didn't last forever. People ask me if I still have them. I say no. But Grandpa always worked. That was the difference between a hobo and a bum. And he was a foreman on the first paved roads in southwest Iowa.
Well, Tim, thanks. So, yeah, thanks for sharing your story. And we need to talk a little bit more about Donnelly's Tavern, which you've got so many stories, Ken, from Donnelly's Tavern, but you've got literary gossip from Donnelly's Tavern, too. You want to tell me a few of the famous folks that spent time there?
Well, let's start with Grant Wood, and this story is somewhat known, but well, I'll tell it anyway. We lived on Grant Street in Iowa City, those of you who know Grant Street, and Grant Wood's studio was a block and a half away on Court Street. And one night, Grant came in the bar with a painting he had done and said to my father, I'll trade you this painting for a case of beer. And my father said, why don't you sell the painting, get the money, and then come back and pay for the case of beer? And think what we would have had if that story was true.
Dad, what a terrible decision.
You could have owned the Pabst Brewery, I think, or a microbrewery.
Right.
And then two other people we all know, I guess, from American literature, Tom Williams, known as Tennessee Williams, went to school in Iowa for a time in the late 30s. And also Dylan Thomas came over for a short time also. Well, my father had to throw both of them out of the tavern because they were overserved, shall we say. They were drunk. And he often said he didn't know how they ever wrote anything because they were not totally sober that often.
He didn't see them at their best. Let's say that. Yes.
That's right.
Well, and of course, some of the most famous Irish from Iowa also, unfortunately, were lost. The Sullivan brothers of Waterloo. Tim, you want to, for people who aren't familiar.
And of course, the Sullivan brothers all died on the sinking of the USS Juno during World War II. And it was one of those situations where two of the brothers had gone into the Navy before World War II and had successfully served, and it had been a wonderful experience for the two of them. And after war was declared in 1941, all five brothers, and they had just been average pluggers, as they say. They didn't particularly distinguished in Waterloo. They had struggled to find work. But all five went down to the recruiting station, and against the general best advice, they were allowed to join together and to sign on to the USS, to join together and serve together on the USS Juno. Well, of course, once the ship sank and all five died and they informed the parents, in some ways, first of all, the loss was overwhelming and there was a tremendous amount of sympathy. But then, of course, the government information folks used that experience to try to motivate people to work harder in defense plants. And then Hollywood got a sense that this might make a good film. And so the Fighting Sullivans becomes a film, and the family kind of goes into to history. Some of it true, some of it not true. There's no question that that kind of sacrifice is what the people of Waterloo aspire to, which is why we have the Waterloo Brothers Convention Center and so forth. But they become singularly important both in the history of World War II in terms of personal sacrifice, but also in a way for Irish courage and Irish patriotism.
So we're nearly out of time here. Ken, how are you going to be celebrating St. Patrick's Day?
I'll be going to the parade in Cedar Rapids on Sunday. My parents were among the founders of the from the County John and Johnson Irish in the parade, and then also going to Des Moines on Saturday. I've never been to that parade.
Yeah, all right.
That's right. And a shout out to Dan Daly of Iowa City, by the way, who portrays St. Patrick at the Sapodapaso Parade. And I think he's on the County Johnson float, I think, this year, but I'm not absolutely sure. If you go up to the parade, when you see St. Patrick, give him a hug.
Dan Daly and I share Kelly cousins.
Oh,
I
see, they're all they're all related. Goodness gracious!
And Tim, even for people in Iowa who are not Irish, who don't have Irish heritage, what do you think we all need to know about Irish in Iowa?
I think, well, first of all, it's that spirit, that risk-taking, that can-do attitude that I think is reflected all across our immigrant heritage. And I think one of the blessings of the various genealogical services that can tell us our makeup is we find out that all of us have a little bit of Irish in us, and that we benefit from it. We embrace it as we embrace all of the other ethnic elements of our makeup, our lives.
And how are you celebrating St. Patrick's Day?
Very quietly. Let's put it this way: I'm not one to celebrate. It's a Sunday, so you go to Mass, right? You go to Mass and pray to God. You know.
Well, Timothy Walsh, thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to be here. Thank you,
Timothy Walsh. His most recent book is Irish Iowa. And Ken Donnelly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone who called in. Unfortunately, we didn't have time for everybody's stories today because, well, there are a lot of Irish in Iowa. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Iowa Public Radio. I'm there as well at Charity Nebbe. And you never need to miss an episode of Talk of Iowa. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts from and listen to Talk of Iowa whenever you like. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Thank you.